Hey, I'm Rick Wilson.
I'm Laurie Lynn, and we are on the front porch.
There are quite a few things we may not agree on.
Unions.
Prevailing wage, right to work.
The coal industry.
Oh, I got one. Reagan versus Roosevelt.
Teddy Kennedy.
I respect you so much that I've stopped referring to Reagan as the Antichrist in your presence.
And you brought me an olive branch from the Garden of Gethsemane.
Where Jesus prayed.
Which is awesome.
We're grateful to West Virginia Public Broadcasting for giving us a place to discuss issues of West Virginia. And we think it's a great service.
It's been fantastic. We're not ranting at each other. We're talking to each other. And people are listening. I appreciate it so much.
You know, we've shamelessly tried to get Tudor's Biscuit World to fund a program that hasn't happened yet. That's why we're relying on you, West Virginia, to support West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Keep us off the streets.
Exactly. We would appreciate your support, and here is how you can contribute.
Call 800-RADIO-87 or go online and pledge, please, at wvpublic.org. Thanks. Hi, and welcome to The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and we're going to talk about President Obama's visit to Charleston, West Virginia, his discussion on prescription drug abuse and heroin abuse and what to do about it, and whether or not he should have talked more about the economy here in West Virginia. And I'm joined, as always, by Laurie Lynn of the Daily Mail opinion page at the Charleston Gazette Mail. Hey, Laurie.
Hi, Scott.
And Rick Wilson, he's with the American Friends Service Committee. Hey.
Hey.
Let's start with the president himself. He arrives and he goes to the East End Family Resource Center here in Charleston and talks about the stigma that's attached with prescription drug abuse.
And let's face it, there's still fear and shame and stigma that too often surrounds substance abuse. That often prevents people from seeking the help that they deserve. Because, you know, when people loosely throw around words like junkie, you know, nobody wants to be labeled in that way. And part of our goal here, I think, today is to replace those words with words like father or daughter or son or friend or sister. Because then you understand there's a human element behind this. This could happen to any of us, in any of our families. What if we replace a word like junkie with recovery coaches and specialists like Jordan? We can't fight this epidemic without eliminating stigma.
Rick, let me start with you. Your daughter works in addiction and helping addicts to recover. What's the role of stigma?
Well, I think it's often a barrier to treatment. I think there's often shame. But what I think they found is once people have access to care, there's a huge demand for it. And I think we have a shortage of that in West Virginia. And she practices mostly in Cabell and Putnam County, but people come from Boone County, from southern West Virginia, from quite a distance to get there. And this is, again, an outpatient thing. This is not an institutionalized setting.
We have a parent who spoke to the president during this town hall meeting. His name is David Grubb. He's a former state senator, a lawyer in town, and he tells a story about his daughter and her struggle with heroin abuse. I'll let him tell it.
Last month, the middle of August, our daughter overdosed. We found her in her bedroom, tourniquet on her arm, syringe next to her. She was already turning blue. My wife administered CPR. We called 911. While we were waiting, I held her and said, "Don't leave us yet." And she is now in recovery. This is her fourth time. It usually takes more than one time, and we think this one will be the one. We are full of hope, but we understand the pain in this room, the pain that families feel. The concern we have is access. Where do you get the treatment? How do you get the treatment? And as soon as this overdose happened, we called hotlines, and we got numbers to call, and we called those numbers, and they said, well, there's a three-month wait, or, well, we don't take Medicaid cards, or, you know, this wasn't really the facility that could handle your type of problem. The other problem with Medicaid cards and things of that nature is you can't always go out of state. What if the facility is across the river? You know, we're a border state. We need to be able to have that ability to go to the facility that may be best for our children. The bottom line is we need resources. And we need to find a way to put those resources into effect so that we have the facilities, because there are so many people that want help, like our daughter. But it took forever to find a place for her. Right now, she's in Michigan. That was the best we could do. Why can't we have lots of these types of facilities with trained staff here in West Virginia, close to home?
So what do we do about it? I mean, everyone seems to agree, sure, more treatment. The president says, you know, he wanted to put $133 million additional dollars into the federal budget to deal with it, but I don't see that happening. You know, is this just like a bunch of words? Everyone agrees and nods their head and says, yes, we should do something, and then we don't do anything about it?
One thing that strikes me, I think the president alluded to prevention and treatment as, you know, the two pieces. And we've been talking a whole lot about the treatment. I haven't heard a ton about what we're doing as far as prevention. I'm sure that there are things going on. That doesn't seem to be the focus as much. I was talking to my colleague Whitney Burdett at the Daily Mail, who is younger than I am and was in high school more recently, and she was observing that there's so much focus on testing and the academic stuff in schools that crowds out kind of time to learn about life and life strategies and balancing your checkbook and certainly ways to, you know, cope with peer pressure. I would be very interested in hearing, you know, what's the latest on how we can actually prevent this from happening? Because that's certainly easier and cheaper than treatment if someone never gets addicted.
Lori and I, and you agree that one thing that we don't do as much now in schools is provide time to talk about issues, to do life skills, because, and again, I'm going to let Lori say this, because I think I'm right there with her. It's all about the testing and things like that. You want to riff on that one?
Well, when I went to, I was in elementary school in the 80s, right? And that was the Nancy Reagan, just say no kind of era. They scared the crap out of us. We had, you know, speakers coming in. We would all get together in the cafeteria and watch a video about, you know, somebody describing their descent into, you know, it was crack and cocaine back then more than this. But that doesn't work on every kid, but it works on some kids. And, you know, again, this goes back to the stigma point, which I completely get. But then I would also be interested in talking to, you know, a drug abuse resistance kind of person and say, well, what's the role that stigma plays on the front end?
Well, I think we learned a lot from the 80s, and what we learned is what works and what does not work in prevention to some degree. And sort of the DARE cop stuff, I think, was less effective than some of the other training that went on that helped to be able to have the skills to say no. And the president, he talked about it's not hopeless. We have successfully battled cocaine and crack and smoking.
Smoking shows that social norms are extremely powerful ways, and to change social norms takes a long time, and it takes education, it takes advertising and things like that. So, and I think it is true. If you look at the pattern of drug abuse, it changes over time. So does the drug, so do the demographics. It's not a constant, I think. But I want to circle back to, I remember in the 90s, we used to do a lot of work in schools on a whole bunch of issues. They used to have peer counseling programs. They used to do a lot more issues about dealing with conflict and things that people were dealing with. And I think they're not doing so much of that now, and probably it's because, you know, being over-programmed at the schools. But then one critique I've had of seeing some drug education programs is the slippery slope idea. I remember seeing things where they would imply to kids, like, if you even take a drink of wine or take one drag on a joint, then you might as well be doing crack because you're already going down the hill. And that's not an effective way, I think, of teaching.
But that's kind of the way we talk about addiction. And I think that, you know, it is a little bit of a double-edged sword. You know, it's a disease, but then you kind of, like you were saying, you get the mentality, well, you know, I did heroin twice, I guess I'm an addict.
This goes back to the issue of the economy and socioeconomics and how they play into addiction. So addiction is like this complicated thing. It's caused in part by your chemistry and your genetics. It's caused by your social upbringing. And it's caused in part by things like, you know, how much stress you're under, whether that be poverty or other things.
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of had this debate over the past couple of days here. You know, is it the economy? Did that cause our addiction problem here in West Virginia? And, you know, I think complex social and economic problems have complex causes, and they're almost always caused by more than one thing. So, you know, yes, the economy definitely played into it. The fact that we had, you know, coal miners with injuries that required, you know, pain medication, and we had some people overprescribing, and maybe drug companies, you know, targeting, and it's possible for things to have more than one cause, and I think we should all be able to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think these issues are overdetermined in some ways. There are many factors that contribute to it, and you know, again, shooting from the hip, you know, you can correlate anything with anything, but it's not the same as establishing direct causation.
Obviously, West Virginia is ground zero for drug overdose deaths. One of the more interesting things I heard this week about that, by the way, is that we may have more deaths not just because we have an addiction problem, but because when people overdose here, it takes longer for medical care to get to people, mm-hmm. and that might cause folks to die who otherwise in more urban areas would have survived. You know, it's hard to measure. What effect does the coal economy and its collapse have on this addiction problem? Bill Rainey of the West Virginia Coal Association, he was at a rally that they had outside of the president's visit, and here's what he had to say about it.
We've got 8,000 coal miners, multiple thousands of support jobs that have been taken out of the equation here in West Virginia because of federal policies, power plants closing. And when people have unemployment, when they don't have a job, when they have uncertainty, then that's fertile ground for substance abuse, and you've got to tie those things together. And you can't come down and think you're going to solve one problem and not pay attention to the other.
So, Rick, should the president have spoken more about the economic collapse going on in Appalachia while he was here?
I think he should have done that a few years ago, provide a short answer for it. I mean, the other thing I would say about the clip we just heard is that the line, because of federal policy, I mean, once again, I understand why he's doing that, but I think it is overdetermined. I think there are market factors, there's gas and everything else. And to say that it all occurs because of federal policy is maybe smart politics, but it's not necessarily the only thing driving it. Also, I was in Martinsburg a couple of weeks ago, and it's one of the hot spots for opium and for addiction, and there are not a whole lot of laid off coal miners in Martinsburg, and it's a national problem. So absolutely, I think the hardships in the coal fields probably contribute to it. It's one of many factors that do, but this has happened in a lot of different places.
Lori, should the president have spoken more about the economic turmoil going on in the state?
Well, he alluded to it, but you know, politically, it's sort of difficult. I mean, if he had kind of broached that subject, I imagine the room would have gone silent, and you know, he felt like that wasn't what he was here to talk about. So he didn't have a lot that he could say. So I don't really fault him that much.
I do.
Okay. Well, I mean,
you're just mad because he gave an interview to the Gazette and not you guys.
No.
Gazette Mail. Sorry, Lori.
Oh, ouch. Yes. But also, I do think that he missed an opportunity. You know, at one point.
What would he have said, though?
Well, he alluded to it.
Yeah.
He alluded to it, but so obliquely. At one point, Lori, he even says, look, I'm not popular here, so I'm just going to tell you what I think. And then he said something that I thought was pretty uncontroversial, which was that race and income play into addiction in ways that, you know, they're causal factors. We all agree. Intelligent people agree with that.
But that seems like a weird point to make here. You know, I mean, you could make that point maybe in a place where it wasn't over 90% white. But, I mean, how is race really playing that strongly into it when, you know, we have communities that are 95% white?
Well, I think you're saying race and poverty and issues like that. In many parts of the world, poverty is more correlated with race, but not so much here.
But I don't want to let the president off the hook. How hard would it have been for him to say, I'm here and I recognize that West Virginia has the highest unemployment rate in the nation. I have proposed Clean Power Plan Plus or Power Plan Plus, I never know what it's called, to help address this. And I call on Congress to pass this, and this is how it would address the economic situation. Why just ignore the fact that you had all these unemployed coal miners rallying right outside? He has nothing to lose, right? He's on his bucket list, as they say. Why not?
No, you're right. And you're alluding to the program that is trying to give communities here money that will retrain people for jobs and economic development. And, you know, I mean, I can't believe I'm defending him, but you're right. He could have said that.
Rick, what's going on here? Why isn't the president talking about
this? I wanted
to
bring that. Like, I think Lori said something last time we were on here that I think we agree on. That is, even if you want to fight the clean power part of it, there's no reason why you shouldn't take advantage of the power plus or something. I think I heard you say that last time.
Yeah, as long as that doesn't prejudice you from being able to make your legal case against the clean power plan, which I don't think it does.
I don't think it does either. I think that'd be one positive thing West Virginia could do. Let's not leave anything on the table, however you feel about, you know, the clean power thing, you know, fight that out or not or whatever, but let's not leave anything on the table that might help the coal fields now. You know, I'll be tougher on Obama. He should have, you know, last time I think he was here was 2010. I was there. It was at the memorial for the Upper Big Branch miners. It would have been nice if some thought would have been given to this consistently, you know, like regularly over the years, things might have looked a lot differently. I think it's a little bit of repentance is late have I loved thee, I believe, as St. Augustine said when he repented.
He's a busy man, right?
Well, that counts as our Bible verse of the podcast, late have I loved
thee. I think that'll have to do. I think it's Augustine, but, you know.
That being said, I give the president a ton of credit for coming here. And even though I'm not born in West Virginia, Laurie and Rick, I feel like I'm a true West Virginian now because I was obsessed with worry that something would happen to embarrass the state during this visit.
And it did.
Really?
I thought we looked pretty good.
Pretty good. I mean, I saw one sign that's been widely circulated on the national media, the sign that says, "Don't blame me, I voted for the American."
Was it spelled correctly, this sign, Rick?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, I'm okay with that. I can live with that. It's embarrassing when it's spelled incorrectly.
Like the Morans.
The man got here, he spoke, he left, he's still alive. I think that's a really – that's where I am right now. I'm just relieved that he made it out of West Virginia.
Most West Virginians are really pretty nice. I mean, we can rant and stuff, but when it gets down to it, we're usually fairly civil face-to-face.
And they protested Dick Cheney at the Greenbrier in September. There were nasty signs there. And
exactly. And I will say that I think the event itself went really well. Brent Webster, who's the Charleston police chief, who got some of the biggest applause of the entire event.
I think this is where most people probably look at the person in uniform and they probably say, okay, this is the guy that's now going to tell us we need to build more jails and make tougher laws. And that's not me. This is such an epidemic. And we cannot arrest our way out of this mess. And I think the president touched on it briefly.
I think there's been a sea change among an opinion about this amongst conservatives and others that the road we've taken the last few decades has not really worked out that well. And, you know, there are websites like Right on Crime where people are talking about this issues and there's work in Congress. I think that represents a major sea change, that cultural change. Really?
Does it make sense to turn our jails into the treatment centers for people with addiction? We spoke with a young woman, Ashley. She got arrested, and they wanted to send her to treatment right away. And instead, there wasn't anything available. And so she was sent to jail for 5 months, and she wanted to go there because she was waiting for the treatment bed to come available. Meanwhile, her kids were separated from her for all those months. It makes so little sense. Why can't we fix this? If there's a growing consensus that this isn't working right, why has it not been fixed yet?
I mean, I think people are trying to take steps to fix it. One thing I've learned recently is that addiction is often complicated if there are mental health issues involved too, and that's often the case. So that's just a complicating factor that can make it harder to do that. Circling back to prevention, though, we talked about older things. One thing that's really been shown to work is early childhood education and home visiting programs that have been done in many states, including states that are very conservative politically. And, you know, there have been some longitudinal studies of what happens when you've had a program that visits women when they're pregnant and stays with them for a couple of years. And it's amazing the long-term effects, both for parents and for kids. So that's one intervention I think is very effective.
I have to say that we've done a whole documentary about these early childhood programs in West Virginia called The First Thousand Days. It would be nice to see what would happen in West Virginia if it was more widely available. In the meantime, let's talk about the final issue that came out of the president's visit, which is Two Doors Biscuit World.
Did he really say it that way?
He did kind of say Two Doors.
I'm going to play for you. You can make up your own mind how he says it.
It is great to be back in what is clearly one of the most beautiful states in the United States of America. One of these days, I'm going to finally try a Two Doors Biscuit.
So yeah, he did that. It was a little awkward at times.
Well, hello, West Virginia. Go Mountaineers.
Lori.
I just don't know why you would come and just start out with Go Mountaineers. It just seems very condescending. I feel like you're a cheap date if you applaud at that. I mean, do you say that in every state you go to? You know, go Cornhuskers, go, you know, Blue Hens of Delaware. I mean, it seems very weird to me. If I were on his advanced team and writing his remarks, I would try to have gone for something a little bit subtler than that. I guess
like go herd. Yay, Marshall.
But tell him to pronounce it correctly.
Yeah, if I would have been his handlers, I would have worked on the whole tutor thing. And also, any person who comes here needs to learn how to say Appalachia correctly.
Did he not say it correctly?
He didn't say Appalachia, I don't believe. I didn't catch that. But Appalachia, you know. Yeah. I do have a funny tutor story. You know, we've been courting tutors for a while. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but we brought in some people from Seattle to do some training and stuff. And Seattle's the home of coffee snobs. And, like, every day they hit tutors for the coffee and for the biscuits. Yeah, I think it's like in Vermont or someplace you might drink Pabst Blue Ribbon, ironically, or something. But they love to. They could not get enough tutors. So.
Well, yeah, and that struck me because, you know, McDonald's has all-day breakfast now, and this is very exciting, apparently, to the rest of the world. But, you know, here in West Virginia, we've been able to get all-day biscuits for a long time, and I think they're better biscuits than McDonald's.
We're innovators in breakfast. We're innovators in opioid drug addiction, too. You know, we're on the cutting edge here in West Virginia.
I should point out, Lori, that tutors generally closes at 2 o'clock. Not that I eat there if my wife is listening, which I don't think she is. But
and that's The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Our podcasts here on West Virginia Public Broadcasting, like The Front Porch, are only possible because of your support, your membership at West Virginia Public Broadcasting at any level. We're in the middle of a pledge drive here, and you know, call and let us know that this is important to you at 1-800-RADIO-87 or pledge online. Click the donate button at wvpublic.org.
Because our shameless attempts to get attention from tutors just haven't panned out so far.
We will keep trying.
You don't want us to be bought by Big Biscuit, right? You want us to be independent and work for you, the members. Call 800-RADIO-87 or go online and pledge, please, at wvpublic.org. And thanks.